Welcome to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM, Vancouver's co-op radio, CFRO, broadcasting live in the downtown east side in unceded Coast Salish territories. Today is Friday, March 21st, 2014. I'm one of your hosts, Cynthia Ganatra, and I'm joined here today by my other co-host, Alyssa Ray.
Hi there.
And Allison Cole.
Hello.
Jackie, Jenny, and Tim are away today. Welcome, everyone, to the show. Animal Voices is Western Canada's only radio program dedicated to animal advocacy and compassionate living, broadcasting live every Friday from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, and we're also available as a podcast. I'm really excited about today's show. We have two great interviews. Our first interview is with Dr. Martin Godwin, who holds several degrees in philosophy and has attended Cambridge University. If you attended Animal Advocacy Camp last year in Vancouver, you'd remember him for his very popular breakout sessions on debating. He will also be hosting a breakout session on debating and arguments in animal rights at this year's Animal Advocacy Camp, which is taking place on March 22nd, 23rd, which is this weekend, 2014, at the Croatian Cultural Center, and you can get your tickets at animaladvocacycamp.ca. So tune in to hear some of Dr. Godwin's tips for common debates in animal rights and a preview of what he has planned for the Animal Advocacy Camp this weekend. So that'll be in about 15 minutes. And our feature interview is with Krista Osborne from Mercy for Animals Canada, and we'll be discussing with her their recent undercover investigation on a turkey farm in Canada. The undercover footage really reveals workers beating, throwing, kicking, and clubbing animals at hybrid turkeys, which is our country's largest turkey breeding factory. So stay tuned for that interview where we hear what the recent developments are in this investigation. And to start the show, Allison's going to share two book reviews with us. So Allison, I'll let you take that.
Yes, well, as you know, I've had the pleasure of testing out many recipes for the last several months now from the books entitled Practically Raw and Practically Raw Desserts. They are both written by Chef Amber Shea Crawley. And even upon first glance, the beautiful photography and the lovely formatting within are enough, in my opinion, to goad one to wanting to try out pretty much every recipe in these books. And I brought the books that we had a brief chance to look at this morning when I got here, and you probably saw like very colorful. And I don't think that is a bad thing since the recipes in these books, they are amazing. They're tantalizing and totally wholesome, using real fresh ingredients, all plant-based, and all for the most part raw. So Amber wrote Practically Raw in 2012, and it's a predecessor to Practically Raw Desserts, which just came out last year in 2013. Amber is both a blogger and a highly trained raw chef, and she has so much expert knowledge to share about food and raw food preparation techniques. And she has recently stopped writing her blog, but you can find it all still intact. It's at chefambershea.com. So Practically Raw, it offers a gamut of food categories such as milks and smoothies, breakfast and brunch, main dishes, and much more. There are even chapters wholly dedicated to kale chips and a chapter all for hummus. Practically Raw Desserts is completely dedicated to, can you guess?
Desserts.
Good job. Desserts. And it presents a melange of sections covering cookies, cakes, pies, puddings, and more. Even though the focus of both books is on raw recipes, one might be surprised to discover such a wide and diverse range of dishes that can be made raw. For example, did you know that you could make a Cantonese veggie stir fry raw? Haven't tried that recipe yet, so I don't know exactly how that's done. However, I did make the chewy chocolate chunk cookies. I always wondered how do raw cookies work, right? And oh my goodness, they were delicious. I didn't get to bring any of those to you because I pretty much ate them all at once.
And you need a dehydrator to make those.
Right? Yeah. So, and you can also make a variety of cakes and cupcakes raw too. So who knew, right? So like any awesome cookbook, both of these books, they also offer generous sections of information at the beginning where the author bestows her special knowledge of nutrition, ingredients, kitchen equipment to use, soaking nuts and sugar substitutions. She talks all about that. I really feel that these foundations for both books really arm the reader with the info that they need to get into the kitchen and start making delicious raw food. Otherwise, it can be a bit daunting, I think. And I always really applaud and appreciate cookbooks that do make the effort to add that extra info straight from the author's treasure trove of specialized knowledge. So as you may have surmised by the clue in the title of both books, these books aren't 100% raw. They are practically raw. So what does practically raw meat mean? So you might wonder, I've never seen this concept before. There are either raw cookbooks or there's normal non-raw cookbooks. So I think it's the practically part of them that really makes them both so unique and accessible. Both books are formatted in the most innovative way and not only does each recipe offer quite a few suggestions for substitutions for many of the ingredients, but there are even options offered for making each recipe either totally raw or cooked. So that means if you don't own a dehydrator, and of course most people don't, then you can still make these recipes that taste equally delicious, but with the use of a conventional oven. So I did make all the recipes from these books raw myself, but I do love the accessibility for the user to make the recipes cooked. I can totally understand the inhibition that a person new to raw food or vegan food even could experience. And when the instructions aren't so rigid, when they're really flexible, I think that it's these options that will allow people to prepare the food in ways that are accessible to them and in ways that they are familiar with, right? So I really like that part about the books. So not only that, as I mentioned, they are beautifully laid out. They have beautiful photographs, like totally scattered within for pretty much every recipe. Very enticing to read through Amber's encouraging and inspiring voice. So I made lots of food from these books. As I mentioned, there is a smoothie section in the Practically Raw book. I made pretty much all the smoothies. The peaches and creamsicle smoothie is to die for, as is the apple pie smoothie. It tastes just like apple pie. There's the standard sort of chocolate smoothie called the Cocoa Corruption smoothie, really delicious with cacao nibs blended into it, and a really nice chocolate-covered strawberry smoothie, which is chocolate and strawberries. Who could want more than that? So the food that I made, both of you, which you might remember, the curried kale chips. I've been bringing lots of kale chips lately, but on my list here, I know I definitely brought the curried ones. I know, Cynthia, you had those ones for sure. Sure.
Yeah, they were delicious. I love kale chips, and I'm Indian, so obviously I love curry. So
a good combination.
They're kind of a great combination for me, and probably anybody who loves kale and curry.
Yeah. So. What about the butternut squash chipotle soup? I made that for the Christmas party. If you remember, I had it in the dehydrator because I wanted to do it authentically raw, and it was just really, really you put butternut squash into the blender, into the Vitamix, and you blend it up with some water or cashews or something. Like, I thought that was really, really tasty and just really fresh. Mm-hmm. Like, these foods are just really fresh. If you remember, also at the Christmas party, I had the Italian sausage pizza, which I just thought it was so flavorful. It was made with a crust that I made in the dehydrator, and I guess the sausage part, I think that was nuts, like walnuts, and it had all these like sort of like pizza spices in it. Mm-hmm. That just made it really, just in my opinion, really tasty. No doubt you remember the raspberry lemon mousse tart,
mm-hmm,
right?
Really.
And yeah, that was really tasty. And the famous 5-minute blondies were so good. That's her most popular recipe in her book and from her blog. And it's so simple to eat and to make. There's like 4 or 5 ingredients in it. It takes 5 minutes and that's it. The New York cheesecake too, of course, was to die for. So I could talk more. So many recipes, very delicious. I really recommend getting both of these books. And yeah, that's all I have for that.
Like what you hear on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM? Donate to the station and become a member of Vancouver's only community-owned and run radio station. As a member-owned cooperative, Co-op Radio doesn't have one owner. We have about 30,000 owners. We don't accept commercial advertising. We generate our revenue through donations from our members and listeners. Donate to Co-op Radio, become a member, and help us continue to make independent alternative radio. Visit cooperadio.org to donate today.
So today we are in the studio on the Downtown East Side recording live. It's Friday, March 21st, as we had said, and all of us here are very excited about the Animal Advocacy Camp, which is tomorrow and Sunday. That's March 22nd and 23rd, Saturday and Sunday, all weekend. It's 18 hours, actually, of Animal Advocacy Camp. It's Vancouver's Animal Rights Unconference. And what does that mean? An unconference is actually where the participants lead the event. You get to decide the agenda and host discussions on what you want to talk about. Even if you're not, you know, an experienced facilitator or you aren't sure, if you have something on your mind that's really important to you or you want to discuss with other advocates and activists, then just put that topic up on the board and other people who are interested will get together with you and discuss casually. There are some featured speakers that weekend as well, speaking, opening the event and closing the event each day. What are you guys excited about?
The food, because I've been organizing that. We have free food on Saturday and Sunday morning, which hasn't been advertised, and free smoothies and free rooibos chai tea, free fruit salad. So that'll be fun.
That's Saturday morning, March 22nd. Yeah. Starts at 9 a.m. until 10 a.m. There's food provided by Eternal Abundance, which is Vancouver's vegan grocery store and cafe. And so, yeah, smoothies and things to get you refreshed and ready and activated and energized and ready to pay attention all weekend to all the amazing things.
Yeah, what I love about the event is it gets all the animal rights people in Vancouver, or even there's people from Seattle, together, and you get to hear what's happening that sometimes we don't even know about. And it's really great to get people working together. And we've discussed this in the show before, having unity in the movement. And I saw they've already posted some of the topics, and that's one of the topics. I'm really excited about that, to get more unity happening in animal rights.
I'm excited too that we have four speakers at the conference this year. So an opening and closer for each day, which is a little bit different than what we've had in the past, and kind of provides the structure for the unstructure of the we call it an unconference, mm-hmm. because we make the people attending make the conference themselves, but it's a bit of a hybrid. There is a bit of structure there where we do have speakers coming, like Joanne MacArthur, who we've had on the show before, and she's amazing. And I've seen her speak before. And
Saturday at 10 a.m.
Yeah, so do not miss
late.
That.
Yeah.
Of course, she's the person she's the main character of the Ghost in the Machines film, which is just an amazing film that everyone should watch.
An award-winning photojournalist, and she's actually been documenting the plight of animals on all 7 continents for over 10 years. So she has a wealth of experience to share, and she's going to share her amazing photography with us.
Yeah, and then also on Sunday, which is unfortunately at the same time as Animal Advocacy Camp, is a protest at the aquarium. And this is amazing. It's a children's protest this Sunday, March 23rd, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., and it welcomes all age groups. And the meeting place is 10:45 a.m. at the entrance of the Vancouver Aquarium, which is in Stanley Park in Vancouver. And you can just ask for Denzel Nair or Andrew Nair, and they encourage people to bring signs, but you don't have to. Some of the signs can say, "Captivity doesn't equal conservation," "You know what's wrong," or "Could you live in a bathtub?" So I think it's great that they're having children protest the aquarium. So if you're free, please go to that. Yeah,
families and children of all ages. It should be a great event. And I forgot to mention Animal Advocacy Camp website is animaladvocacycamp.ca. It's hosted by Liberation BC. Make sure to check out details about how to register. I'm sure that there's tickets available at the door, but it's $60 for both days or $35 for one day. And I just have one event coming up in April that I want people to mark their calendars for. So Animal Voices and Liberation BC are very excited to host a film screening of Live and Let Live on Tuesday, April 15th at 7 p.m. downtown at SFU Harbor Center. So Live and Let Live is a new documentary produced by a German fellow named Mark Pierschel, and he's going to be with us for a Q&A. Live and Let Live is a feature documentary examining our relationship with animals, the history of veganism, and the ethical, environmental, and health reasons that move people to go vegan. From butcher to vegan chef, from factory farmer to sanctuary operator, Live and Let Live tells the stories of 6 individuals who decided to stop consuming animal products, and tells about the impact it has on their lives. And it features a lot of the main philosophers of the movement, and we're very excited. So Tuesday, April 15th, mark your calendars.
Awesome. I'm excited about that too. So you're listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, BC. And we're going to have our next interview now.
We are joined now by Dr. Martin Godwin, who will be appearing at the 2014 Animal Advocacy Camp. Welcome to the show, Dr. Godwin.
Hello, thank you very much.
So how did you become such a masterful vegan debater?
Well, I guess it takes a few years of practice. I've always been interested in philosophy and philosophers tend to specialize in argument and debate. So really just years of practice, I suppose.
Can you tell us a little bit about your educational background and how you got some of this experience and knowledge related to vegan debating?
Well, like most people growing up in Britain, I'm from London, England originally. I grew up in a thoroughly meat-eating environment. I was always interested in philosophy, and after some various detours into other careers, I eventually went to study philosophy at Southampton University. I enjoyed it immensely. I loved it so much, so it didn't feel like work. Unfortunately, I did well enough to go on to Cambridge, did my master's there, did some more philosophy, and eventually ended up at UBC in Vancouver, where I did my PhD. My interest in veganism and vegetarianism really started whilst I was at Southampton. I, together with my then partner, we decided that we would cut meat out of our diet, aside from fish. We still had fish on a fairly regular basis. And it just seemed like the right choice to make at the time. And of course, being interested in philosophy, I was interested in the arguments in favor of the choices that seemed to me to be the right choices to make.
Awesome. And so can you tell us a little bit about how you became vegan and your personal interest in veganism?
Well, I don't describe myself as vegan. For one thing, I have, for example, a leather belt, which I bought about 25 years ago, which is still serving functional use. So I don't describe myself as vegan. I prefer vegetarian. My interest in veganism and how I developed it. Initially, I have to say that my move towards cutting meat out of the diet was primarily financial. As a student, it just seemed a lot cheaper. But there was also, I think, some part of my psychology which made me, or led me to think that it was somehow the right choice to make. The arguments that I later explored in favor of those choices seemed to make much more a great deal of sense to me, but were not the initial motivation for me to give up meat.
And in the academic world, do you ever face backlash or opposition related to views promoting veganism or vegetarianism or animal rights and similar topics?
Not a great deal. I mean, certainly most of my colleagues, most of the people I know in academia are not vegetarians or vegans. However, in an academic environment, people are encouraged to think independently, and people are generally encouraged to think things through. And as such, there's a great deal of respect for people's positions, even if they're rather radical positions in comparison to the norm that most people have it. So I haven't experienced any direct opposition. Obviously, individuals have different choices, and by and large, we tend to respect each other's opinions.
Well, that's really great to hear. Sadly, not all settings in the world are so respectful and have so much consideration given to them. So I wondered if you could give us your responses to some common arguments against veganism and animal rights that I hear a lot.
Okay, I'll do my best.
Okay, awesome. So the first one is pretty common. Plants have feelings too. We eat plants, why not eat animals?
Well, the claim seems to rest on a rather dubious premise. As far as I am aware, and I've looked at some comments by experts, biologists and botanists, it's unlikely that plants have feelings too. It's very unlikely that they have any direct conscious awareness of the world around them. They react to the world around them, certainly, but then so do pretty much any object in the world will react to the world around it in certain ways. It's unlikely, therefore, that the plants have feelings too. It's unlikely, though of course always possible, that they feel pain. As such, there is a principled moral distinction that we may draw between plants and animals. Animals do feel pain. They have a central nervous system, just like human beings. They have pain sensors, just like human beings. And it seems very likely that they feel pain in essentially the same way that we human beings feel pain. Plants, however, lack that central nervous system, and therefore probably do not feel pain. Now, there might be other moral reasons to take into consideration the interests or needs of a plant, but it is likely to form to constitute a very different moral category in virtue of lacking the ability to feel pain, to suffer, or to be happy.
Okay, so you shot me down there. What about this one? So if you were on a desert island, you'd have to eat animals. So we should eat animals all the time, because if we were on a desert island, we would all die if we didn't kill animals.
The obvious response to that is we're not on a desert island. When we make our moral choices, we have to make our moral choices in the context that we find ourselves. Obviously, there are some contexts, and Peter Singer, for example, a staunch advocate for animals, has accepted, and I accept with him too, that there may be certain circumstances, relatively rare circumstances, where we as individuals might be required morally to kill or eat other animals. But the fact of the matter is, for the vast majority of us, in the vast majority of circumstances we find ourselves, we aren't faced with those kinds of choices. We can always go down to the supermarket and make our dietary choices, our food choices, without having to concern ourselves with, well, what would we do if we were on a desert island with nothing else to eat? We're not on a desert island. We do have other things to eat.
You're killing me here. Not literally. All right, how about this one? It's just the circle of life. Animals eat other animals. It's just a natural part of being a creature on planet Earth to eat other beings.
Yes, this is one of the most common arguments that one hears. It's often appealed to. Basically, the argument runs like this. It is natural, therefore, it is morally permissible. But that simply doesn't follow. There are many things that are, in some sense, natural, but do not seem to us, at least, to be morally permissible. It's at least arguable that infidelity may be natural. It doesn't follow that it's therefore morally permissible. It may be natural for human beings to be aggressive. War might be natural, too. It doesn't follow that it's morally permissible. This fallacy was identified a long time ago and is often called the naturalistic fallacy because it invalidly infers from the way that things are, even the way that things are in nature, to the moral conclusion that it is therefore morally permissible. But things are not morally permissible just because they occur in nature. Neither are things morally impermissible just because they don't normally occur in nature. I brush my teeth. It doesn't follow that there's anything morally problematic about that, even though it's not, in an obvious sense, a natural practice.
All right. Okay. What about this one? Animals aren't as smart as people.
I think, depending on how we define smart, that is probably true. Human beings are clearly very intelligent species, but depending on how we define intelligence, there are plenty of non-human animals who can outcompete us in many cognitive abilities. Even the humble crow, or the humble jay, I should say, can outcompete human beings in the capacity to remember where they stored things. I can't even find my keys on many occasions, but a jay can locate food stashes in the order of hundreds, perhaps even thousands. It's an extraordinary memory feat. But even if we were to allow that human beings are smarter than non-human animals, it's not at all obvious that that would account for a moral difference, a significant moral difference between humans and non-human animals. As Peter Singer makes the point very clearly, if we were to consider a human being who lacked the intelligence that the typical human being has, perhaps an unfortunate child who's had severe brain damage and will never develop the cognitive capacities that the average human develops, we wouldn't presumably say that that unfortunate child lacks the kinds of rights that we typically ascribe to human beings, especially, for example, the right not to endure pain, the right to life, and so on. So what Peter Singer points out, and I agree, is that intelligence is not an obviously significant moral difference. It is a difference, but not one that carries much significant or much moral weight.
So are there some situations when you think a logical argument might not work and might not be successful in convincing your opponent?
My impression is that arguments have a role, but a relatively limited role in persuading people to change their behaviors. Most people like to think of themselves as rational, but the fact is the matter is that we're all irrational to some degree. None of us are perfectly rational. We all have emotions and so on that can affect our decisions. We all have habits. We all have cultural pressures that press us in certain directions. I think that reason, argument, has a role to play, but most people in my experience are more likely to change their behaviors, more likely to feel moved to give up eating meat, if they have some kind of emotional connection or experience with a non-human. I think experiences like that carry more weight for most people. Now, I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. I plug away and do what I can to try and present the arguments as rationally as I can and hope that it will have some effect. But sometimes I feel like it's a bit like the effect of water on a rock. It will wear it down eventually over time, but it's not something that's going to move it in the short term sometimes. And some people are moved, but moved by reason, that is. But most people are pretty damn set in their ways, it has to be said. So it takes a lot of work, and generally speaking, I think other ways of changing people's behaviors tend to be more successful than reason, at least in the short term.
And so what do you think are some of the best ways to convince someone to change their behavior?
Well, I think if you engage with people who are meat eaters, if you have a discussion with people who are meat eaters, the first thing to do, I think, is to try to keep one's emotion out of the picture. It's the easiest thing in the world to dismiss someone's perfectly cogent argument if they're getting emotional in the matter. It's easy to dismiss them as hysterical. So the first thing I try to do is just stay calm, to listen carefully to what the person believes, and to try to draw out from them some shared common principle that you think can be used to persuade them that some of their actions are not in keeping with their moral principles. For example, most people are perfectly happy to admit that we shouldn't cause unnecessary pain to others. So if one can then go on to argue that many of their eating practices, if they're eating, for example, factory-farmed food, factory-farmed meat, it's relatively straightforward, I think, to persuade them that they are doing things which cause unnecessary pain to others. And as such, they will typically feel a sense of discomfort or perhaps even inconsistency between what they're doing and their espoused moral beliefs. Now, of course, there are lots of maneuvers and tricks and sometimes fallacies that they might use to try and escape from the logical conclusion that they should draw. But that's the matter. There's lots of different ways that they can try to avoid the conclusion. But fundamentally, I think the best strategy is to try to get some agreement about moral principles. If I can get an agreement about moral principles, then it's relatively straightforward to argue for vegetarianism or veganism.
That's wonderful. Can you tell us a little bit about the breakout sessions that you'll be running at this year's Animal Advocacy Camp on March 22nd and 23rd?
Well, my plan would be to have a session in which any participants, anyone who's interested in rational argument, anyone who's interested in arguing more rationally or effectively, I hope, for animal rights and animal welfare. What I will hold is a kind of clinic, arguing for animals, a clinic where what I will do is essentially what we've done today, consider certain arguments for or against veganism or vegetarianism, and explain why the arguments against veganism and vegetarianism don't work rationally, and give some advice about how they might best become effective rational advocates for animals.
Well, that sounds pretty interesting. That event will be happening, of course, on March 22nd and 23rd at the Croatian Cultural Center, where you can meet Dr. Godwin in person. And is there anything you learned from your sessions last year? Were there any really great questions that came up that you'd like to share with our listeners today?
I got lots of great questions when I hosted the sessions last year. For me, it was a wonderful experience. The first time I attended the Animal Advocacy Camp, and it was a great experience. I really loved it. It was wonderful to talk with people who understood where I was coming from and sharing experiences. There are too many, I think, questions and arguments. I'm sure when we all try to argue for animals, we're faced with such a multitude of different arguments that sometimes can seem bewildering, and we often feel stumped. And part of what I want to do is to help people not feel so stumped and not feel so vulnerable to such objections.
You can meet Dr. Godwin in person on March 22nd and 23rd at Animal Advocacy Camp, taking place at the Croatian Cultural Center in Vancouver. For more information, you can head to animaladvocacycamp.ca. Thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Godwin.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You are listening to 100.5 FM CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver. This is Animal Voices, and we just have a couple quick news stories for you. First, in Canadian hunting news, the Fur Bear Defenders reported that there's only 455 professional hunters and trappers left in Canada. According to Statistics Canada's 2011 household survey, trapping has become one of the least common full-time professions for Canadians. It appears to be a trend. It's down from, 2001 and 2001 and 2006 both reported about 1,200. So 2011 showing 455. So that's in part due to lowering pelt prices driven by lowering demand for fur. And ongoing educational efforts and actions like fur bans are also having an impact. Now, looking to worldwide hunting news, this week it was announced that Botswana is banning canned hunting. Canned hunting is the practice in which large carnivores, such as lions or other wild individuals, are raised in captivity and hunted in small camps. They have no room to escape or chance to elude the hunter. Botswana's Ministry of Environment, Wildlife and Tourism said in a statement on Thursday that efforts are underway to strengthen legislation to ensure that this abhorrent and unethical practice doesn't find its way into Botswana under any guise. The ministry said that they're committed to conserving biodiversity and do not tolerate cruelty to wildlife in any form. The development comes after the Department of Wildlife and National Parks in the ministry banned exports of wildlife, including captive carnivores, in January, and they've also banned trophy hunting, effective in January of this year, in preference for photographic tourism. And one more quick hunting story I found this week. There's lots in the news. Hunters in Iran destroy their weapons and vow to stop killing wildlife. There's an amazing photo of men standing around this huge fire where bird traps are found. I think hunting like partridges and small birds there is really popular. So they were burning them. So what happened was some hunters in the Kurdistan region have made a remarkable commitment to change their ways for the sake of wildlife. They burned their traps, broke their rifles, and vowed to stand in solidarity with animals they once targeted. This move comes weeks after Iranian Environmental Ministry released a report indicating 74 species native to the country had been placed on the red list in danger of extinction. So there was about 20 hunters that once educated by people who went around to the communities and telling them about these numbers, they mobilized to create this event. So hopefully it makes waves and we see more and more of this.
Yeah, that's great. Recent PETA undercover investigation reveals cruel and corrupt practices happening in the horse industry. So PETA, after conducting undercover investigation on a quite famous trainer named Steve Asmussen and one of his in his racehorsing operation. So Steve Asmussen ranks second in career victories with more than 6,700, and he's earned over $214 million. So obviously he's one of the main horse racer guys. And the video basically shows that Asmussen and his top assistant trainer, Scott Blassie, subjecting the horses to cruel and injurious treatments, administering drugs to them for non-therapeutic uses, and having one of their jockeys use an electric device to shock the horses into running faster. Obviously, we've heard of this happening. This is the first time we actually have some video. And so as a result of these findings, PETA has filed complaints with the federal and state agencies in Kentucky and New York, saying that it's moose and force injuries and suffering on the horses to race and train. So that video is up on PETA's website, and you can find out more information there about this. And so there were 7 hours of video, and this trainer that worked for them, I just saw they were only paying him $5 an hour, this undercover investigator. So I just thought that was an interesting little fact.
Wow.
Yeah,
it's a lot of in entertainment industries like that say, like, well, of course we treat them the best possible because, you know, they're money to us and they're so valuable, but really behind the scenes it's a different story. So glad that's coming out. CBC News BC story for our final story of the day. A Kamloops BC man has been found guilty of causing unnecessary pain and suffering to an animal. Last year, he strangled a cat to death with his bare hands and threw her into a dumpster. 27-year-old Stephen Seidel was convicted of the criminal code offense in court on Thursday. He was also convicted on two charges under the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals Act, but they were stayed in light of the criminal code conviction. He faces up to 18 months in jail and a $10,000 fine and could receive a lifetime ban on being in care of animals. SPCA Chief Investigator Marcy Moriarty said that she said more and more courts are taking the cases of animal cruelty seriously, arguing strongly that no behavior that causes pain or suffering to an animal is acceptable.
Yeah, and I also read that story on, and I read on there that the law allows owners of animals to kill them regardless of their health, but there's always laws around suffering and stress that the animal may endure. So basically, you can put down your animal whenever you like, regardless of their health, which I found quite an alarming statement. And also that the man who strangled this cat also said that he did it because he couldn't afford the SPCA, but he was also drunk when he did it. So, I mean, obviously there's other things going on.
It's pretty interesting how the mode of killing is like considered so different. If you do it with your hands, that's one thing. But if you do it with a needle, that's a totally different thing, and it's fine.
Yeah.
It's fine.
And you're allowed to kill them whenever. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was our news. And moving on to our feature interview, which is with Krista Osborne from Mercy for Animals, who will be discussing their recent undercover turkey farm investigation. Krista is Director of Operations for Mercy for Animals Canada, and she holds several degrees, including a master's in leadership, for which she wrote a thesis on the rigorous working conditions of slaughterhouses in the southern United States and the deep interconnections between human rights and animal rights. Awesome. So hello, Krista, and thank you for joining us on Animal Voices today.
Hi, Cynthia. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for being on the show.
It is my pleasure.
Awesome. So for our listeners who may not have heard of Mercy for Animals Canada, can you briefly tell us about the work you do?
Oh, I would love to, Cynthia. So obviously, Mercy for Animals Canada, some folks may have heard of Mercy for Animals in the U.S. We're, of course, the Canadian operation. We're dedicated, of course, to preventing cruelty, in particular to farmed animals, and to promoting very compassionate food choices and compassionate policies. And I hear you talking certainly about the law, which is a serious concern for us as well. We believe that we serve animals through consumer education initiatives, through cruelty investigations, through corporate outreach, and of course through legal advocacy.
Awesome. And we've obviously haven't had you on the show before, but we've had Mercy for Animals Canada on the show because you've had two previous investigations in Canada, and your most recent investigation is at a turkey farm in Canada. Can you tell us where this occurred and what it uncovered?
Sure. Happy to, and you're absolutely right. We did a pig investigation at Puritone in Manitoba in 2012, and we also did an investigation at Burnbrae Farms, and in particular, two of their producers called Creekside Farms and Cuckoo Farms in Alberta. Mm-hmm. Our most recent investigation was certainly at hybrid turkeys, and hybrid turkeys is just outside of Kitchener, Ontario, in a little town called Bright. In case some of you don't know Bright, it is, again, just near Kitchener. It is the largest turkey breeder in the country and the second largest in the world. So it really is a breeder for other breeders. So every turkey that you see in every grocery store everywhere is very directly connected to hybrid turkeys. If you're asking what we saw, it is definitely heartbreaking. We saw workers who were punching, who were throwing, kicking, and beating the turkeys. We saw workers that were crushing the spines of these beautiful birds, bashing their heads in with large metal rods and with shovels. All of the activity that our investigators saw was all with the full knowledge of management. And we also witnessed a practice whereby the birds were bred to grow so big so quickly that their little feet literally could not hold their bodies up any longer. So they were literally born, couldn't stand up, and couldn't even move, obviously, based on the way they were bred.
Yeah, I saw the video, and I was telling Allison and Alyssa earlier that it was actually, and I've seen a lot of horrific videos, some of the worst I've seen, especially with some of those turkeys and their intestines hanging out of them and prolapses, and it was
absolutely
quite horrific for me to see, and I see a lot of that. And
I know.
Yeah.
And yeah, I saw not all, but a good portion of the footage that isn't even on our website, and it is literally heartbreaking. These birds are very gentle, gentle souls. I think we call them mother hens for a reason. They are compassionate, and they are gentle, gentle creatures that really only want to be treated in the same way that we treat our cats and our dogs.
Yeah. I've met turkeys before. They're lovely. They're great. So obviously, is this industry practice, especially with how they were putting the turkeys down by beating them with the metal clubs?
So, I mean, is it industry practice? You know, our undercover footage goes in and shows industry practice.
Mm-hmm.
We go into these establishments on a random basis. Our investigators don't target any particular farm. So when we go in, we see industry standard. We want to be the eyes and ears of the public, and we simply show them what is the regular practices of any organization, and hybrid turkeys is no different. Hybrid turkeys has certainly tried to take the position that these have been isolated incidents, but there's no question in our minds that this has been a culture of cruelty. Hidden camera footage doesn't lie. The neglect was absolutely egregious. If you look at some of the footage, these birds were left with festering wounds that in certain cases were even covering over with black, almost crusts, and that only happens over periods of time. The other thing, I don't know if any of your listeners had the opportunity to watch The National last night with Peter Mansbridge, but there was a portion of the National last night where Erica Johnson from Marketplace did a follow-up piece on the hybrid turkey incident, and where more whistleblowers, up to four, have actually come forward anonymously because they do live in the community, but they were previous employees and have confirmed everything that our investigators saw and have confirmed that it was going on for very elongated periods of time up to a year ago.
Sorry, this is Alyssa. Just, I know often with these farms being shown, that the bad things happening at these farms, the media and the industry seems to say, oh, it's just that one farm, it's just those people. With this particular facility, which is a breeding facility that's so big across the country and so connected, what do you think, like, the fallout will be, or how is the media and the public, like, going to respond? Because it's like, often, you know, it'll be like, oh, McDonald's cut off their supplier, or they're no longer associated with that farm. But with this institution, it seems so connected. How do the industry save face? Like, what are they trying to, what will they do?
Well, we all know how we'd really like them to save face, but we know that's not going to happen. But how do they save face? I mean, one of the interesting things that Erica Johnson talked about last night on this video clip, which is on, if any of your listeners might want to go to our Facebook page, which is Mercy for Animals Canada, we have a link to, it was about a 2.5 minute follow-up, but it was very powerful. And there was a statement from Maple Leaf Farms, because Maple Leaf Foods, rather, I said farms, I didn't mean that, but Maple Leaf Foods gets all their turkeys one way or another through hybrid turkeys, and they've indicated that they are going to be performing random and unannounced inspections of these various hybrid locations. It's also important to note that of the whistleblowers that came forward, they did come forward from different hybrid facilities, not all within that Bright facility. Mm-hmm. There were other facilities as well. There was even a lady who was on the CTV and spoke, in fact, not anonymously, spoke very clearly and crisply on television about her experiences at the AYR plant, and that is just spelled AYR. As it relates to your question about the public, there's no question that the public have been horrified. One thing I wanted to pick up on, and I was listening to you ladies before this segment, and you were talking about how people's views are changing a little bit and having a greater compassion for animals, and certainly farmed animals. We've really seen that evolution over the last number of years as well. I don't know that I could count the number of emails that we got to our info, our main info email line at Mercy for Animals Canada, but I can tell you that it was just, I cried a couple of times as I'm reading these emails because people are horrified, and they should be. And the public outcry is huge, and they do not believe that this is an acceptable way to treat any animal, whether it's a cat, a dog, a turkey, or any other animal in our communities.
Well, I think this happens after a lot of undercover investigations. Like many Canadians think we don't even have factory farms. I think they think factory farms are just farms in the States, that Canada is completely different, that we have these idyllic farms that they show on the packaging of all the foods, not just the organic foods. All the foods show, you know, happy chickens and happy cows and laughing cows and happy turkeys. And so I think people are often quite shocked, I wouldn't say especially in Canada, but maybe because they think, even when I tell people that there's still battery cages after your other investigation, people were shocked that that actually happens here. So I think it's good. So why do you think Canadians are don't realize what's happening?
You know, first of all, I think you're absolutely right. And that's why Mercy for Animals Canada is in Canada. And that's why we've just done this third investigation with more to come. But I hear the same things. I hear people say to me, oh, we're totally different than the U.S. Well, the reality is we're exactly the same as the U.S. as it relates to what we call on-farm conditions. So you're exactly right, talking about confinement, talking about small spaces, talking about the desensitization of these workers. And in fact, we're actually worse than the U.S. in other ways as it relates to animal agriculture. I would give you ladies one example of that would be in the transportation area. When the animals leave the farms and they're in the transportation trucks that we all see on the highway, I'm sure all of us look at them and we all feel a little sick to our stomachs. But we allow single-chambered stomach animals, so we think of pigs and horses, they're allowed to be on a transport truck for 36 hours without water, food, rest, the ability to lie down. And for other animals, like cattle and goats, they can be on a truck for 52 hours. And in both of those scenarios, those durations of time can be extended by 5 hours if the hauler can reach that destination within that five-hour window. Whereas in the U.S., they have a cap of 28 hours for the transportation of all large animals. So we're not better than the U.S., and arguably, we're worse in many, many areas. It's a complicated area. But there's no question that we at Mercy for Animals Canada are the only Canadian organization doing undercover investigations again in Canada. There's nobody else that does that in Canada. And we are here to show your listeners and to show everybody what really goes on in these places.
That's great. I mean, I think you've already had three. We're looking forward to more investigations. Oh, looking forward,
stay
I think
tuned,
it's a funny,
there
funny
are
thing,
more.
It's a funny thing to say, looking forward to investigations when they're horrific.
Looking but, forward to opening people's minds and eyes.
Exactly. That's exactly. Yeah. So a little bit back to hybrid turkeys. So I researched them a little bit. They're a division of a Netherlands-based Hendrix Genetics, which I just is insane in the first place that this is they specialize in breeding of turkeys, and as you mentioned, to make the turkeys so large so quickly, which is sounds like something out of a sci-fi movie. So their response, what has exactly been the response? You said that they said it's an isolated incident. Have they said anything else about it?
And that's a
great
question.
Taken any actions?
So they have. I mean, you're right. First of all, your research is bang on. They are the parent company is Hendrix Genetics. And by the way, Hendrix actually has operations in over 24 countries. They are just an enormous organization. And they have responded. They've responded in a couple of ways. First of all, they responded by suspending the particular four workers that were clearly seen on the video. But it's always interesting because they were suspended with pay. I don't know about you guys, but if I got suspended with pay, I'd call that a vacation. but in any case, that's what they're calling a suspension, is to do whatever you want, sit home and get paid.
Yeah. Well, probably because they don't want them to talk to the media, or because they realize that it's not an isolated incident, that they're probably not told to do these things or something.
Yeah.
So they're trying to just keep them happy, their workers.
Yeah, I doubt the workers are very happy, though, because we're also looking at bringing criminal charges. We're working currently with the Ontario Provincial Police. And that's not a particular secret. We've been pretty candid about that we are looking to lay criminal charges against these individuals. So that has been one of their responses. The other response was, of course, to call it an isolated incident. I have not seen any responses since the airing on the National last night. One of the other things that you may have noted is that Hybrid Turkeys tried to take the position that the animals that were shown on the video that had the eyes bulging, that were very ill, they tried to take the position that they were in hospital pens, but our investigator clearly indicated that there were no hospital pens at Hybrid anywhere. And the whistleblowers, as part of that segment last night, verified that to be true, that there were no hospital pens. So I haven't seen any responses since then. I think they know they're caught in a very blatant lie. My understanding, though, is the woman that has been speaking on behalf of Hybrid, that they are likely pulling her and bringing forth a new front face. Because our sense, and I think we're all going to be glad about that, but our sense is that she hasn't done a great job. So, of course, we'll have a little chuckle over that.
Yeah, it's interesting. At least they're speaking. I remember with the chicken story, they weren't talking, and they were closing their barn doors. And it's always interesting to see how they react to these undercover investigations.
The Canadian industry isn't used to this happening, and now that MFA Canada is in the country, they should start getting used to it.
Yeah.
And we're not going anywhere, folks. No. We are here to stay, and they're getting nervous. After the Puritone investigation, actually, which was the pig investigation in Manitoba, the work that we did with the undercover investigation in part led to the National Farm Animal Care Council completely redoing the standard of care for pigs, which was just announced 2 weeks ago.
That's great.
So we're here to stay, and we are going to be in every factory farm that we can be in from one end of the country to the other until such time as the animals don't need us anymore.
Yeah. So what actions can our listeners take to do something about this? I know there's a petition.
Absolutely. We would ask all of your listeners to visit turkeytorture.ca. There is a petition, and petitions are extraordinarily powerful. It is those petitions that helped us in the Puritone matter. We had almost 5,000 people sign the Puritone petition. We had 4,700 submissions of concerned Canadians who individually emailed the National Farm Animal Care Council. Mm-hmm. Please, please sign these petitions. They are important. And reach out to these organizations. I can't tell you the number of people that are emailing Hybrid Turkey and Maple Leaf. And, you know, those things are powerful things that every listener can do. Of course, we always want people to leave turkey off their plates. We are unabashedly a vegan organization, and we believe that every time we sit down, we can help the animals by choosing kindness and by choosing a lovely meal that is vegan and that doesn't hurt any animal.
Yeah, definitely.
And of course, we certainly welcome donations. I won't be shy about that. We are a fully donor-funded organization. 100% of everything we do is paid for by each of you. And without that, we wouldn't be here, and we want to be here for a really long time.
Great. Well, thank you, Krista, so much for being on the show. It was lovely speaking to you. And hopefully we'll speak to you again after your next investigation.
Well, you'll want to call me. Trust me.
Okay. Well, we're looking forward to changing people's minds, as Allison said. So for more information, as you mentioned, you can go to turkeytorture.ca or mercyforanimals.ca. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks, ladies. Bye-bye.
Bye. So you have been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. Just wanted to let people know that if you enjoyed this show and you want someone else to listen to it on the radio, on the actual radio, we are actually rebroadcasting our next two shows for the next few weeks on Tuesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. on 100.5, so you can tune in there. Please join us on next week's show. We will be recapping and playing clips from Animal Advocacy Camp on next week's show, also interviewing Mercedes Arnhorn, who is the vegan singer and guitarist of the Juno-nominated band called Courage My Love. Please stay in touch with us on our website, animalvoices.org. You can listen to all of our past shows there. And please do send us your suggestions and comments about the show either on Facebook, Animal Voices Vancouver, or email radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. We're closing the show now with Turkey Song by Dr. Will Tuttle. Please stay tuned for Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today. And remember to be kind to the animals.
But why take revenge on one who loves you so? Surely there's another way for you to be. Don't you ever get tired of hurting me? You must think that I look bad with a smile. For you haven't let me wear one in such a long, long while. Still I keep running back. Why must this be? Don't you ever get tired of hurting me? Get tired of hurting me.